Before I get started, I want to say thank you for inviting me. It's wonderful to be back in Waterloo. I drove around a few of my old spots, although I found that it was quite difficult to actually make it anywhere in this town. I actually got lost last night, which is embarrassing, right, because I lived here. Except the streets don't make any sense. They intersect one another multiple times, and it's very easy. Anyway, it was a mess, but I made it. All right. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the dawn of gravitational wave astronomy. And I'll actually start this story all the way back with Isaac Newton. So I think it's fair to say Newton gave us a ton of stuff in both physics and mathematics, but I imagine that he is most known for, can people see the screen, by the way? Should we dim the light some more? I know what the talk says, so it doesn't matter to me. I think it's fair to say that Newton is probably best known for his description of gravity. So Newton related the force between two objects under gravity as being proportional to the product of their masses and inversely proportional to the, to the radius squared. Perfect. That's okay. Like, literally, the last talk I gave, the projector stopped working. So this is already better. Okay, so Newton described the force between gravity as proportional to the product of the masses and inversely proportional to the distance between two objects squared. And this, along with obviously his foundational contributions to classical mechanics and calculus, let him ultimately predict the motion of planets and describe quantitatively Kepler's laws from this sort of first principles description of the force of gravity. And Newton's theory of gravity remained the theory of gravity for hundreds of years to follow. And actually, with the exception of the people in this room, probably, a large portion of the community, even some of the physics community, would turn to Newton's gravity as the description of gravity. Unless you have situations in which you require either you have extremely strong gravitational interactions or require extremely precise measurements, Newton's gravity does a good job of describing the dynamics. And it really wasn't until we went on to try to understand some of the other fundamental forces in nature that we ultimately revisited gravity. So especially throughout the 1800s, people were really trying to understand quantitatively electricity and magnetism. And during that entire process, many new ideas emerged, and namely the idea of the electric field and the magnetic field. And ultimately, the description of classical electrodynamics was a quantitative description of these fields, how you could create the fields, how you could manipulate the fields with charges and currents. And we also realized that the way these fields change, these fields that pervade all of space, were not instantaneous, and in fact, changes to the fields would propagate at finite speed. So one of the predictions that come out of classical electromagnetism was that it was possible to have these self-sustaining oscillations in the electric and magnetic fields. And these electromagnetic waves were predicted by the theory to travel at precisely the speed of light. And this, of course, is not a coincidence. We now know that light and radio and other things are, in fact, electromagnetic waves. This wave phenomenon, though, was a bit different than other wave phenomena that people understood at the time. So in this room, with the exception of the fact that I'm connected through a loudspeaker, if I turned off this mic, the way you would be hearing me would be because my voice would be making a pressure wave in the air. The pressure wave would vibrate your eardrum, and you would hear that. If we didn't have any air in the room for the sound to travel through, you wouldn't hear my voice. People were wondering at the turn of last century if there was a medium for these electromagnetic waves, some special frame that light traveled through, sort of like air for sound. But experimental results, actually extremely clever experimental results that ultimately ended up having a huge bearing on the gravitational wave field, never found any preferred medium for light, and in fact found the speed of light to be the same for all different observers. And then, of course, along comes Albert Einstein, and he perhaps made roughly Well, he made basically the obvious, asked us to do the obvious thing, which is to just accept the experimental data regarding the speed of light as correct, as just truth. The speed of light was always the same regardless of observers. And if that's true, this is quite different than our normal experience. Hopefully there's some XKCD fans out there. I've clearly stolen this, modified to my own purposes. If we have a person who's standing still and throws a baseball with some speed, we'll see the baseball move. If they're running and they throw the baseball, presumably if they can throw the baseball with the same heft that they would have had they been standing still, we'll see the baseball move at some different speed. That's the sum of the velocity of their motion and the baseball's motion. But in the case with light, it would be different. If we had a flashlight instead of a baseball and we tried to observe the speed of light, depending whether or not even the person is standing still or running, we would still observe this flashlight to send off a light wave at the same speed. And if we accept this as being true, then it really means that we have to change something else. Something else has to give if the speed of light is the same for all observers. And what has to give is the very notion of space and time itself. So from this, we know Einstein went on to describe special relativity. And in special relativity, distances and elapsed times are no longer something we can take for granted. Space and time is not this rigid thing, but depends on your perspective. If we go back to the baseball at zero velocity or some small velocity would be this nice spherical thing. If we throw it at a speed approaching the speed of light, the faster it goes, the more it appears to contract along the direction of propagation. It gets shorter and shorter.
Not to be a pedant, but it doesn't actually contract in the way it rotates.
Fair enough.
They showed this in every freshman physics book, but it's wrong.
Fair. Okay.
A two-dimensional baseball.
Okay, fair. Okay. This is a two-dimensional screen, so we're okay. Everything is fine. Okay, so and similarly, if we had instead this person who was running and was throwing the baseball, it's possible that in the case of the observer who's standing watching this baseball player run, we may watch this baseball player run for, say, 5 hours, but if the baseball player were running at some enormous speed close to the speed of light, they may only observe 5 minutes, for example, pass on their watch. And Einstein, ultimately, after realizing that space and time were not something we could think of as being absolute, didn't stop there and related gravity, in fact, to the geometry of space and time, and described massive objects as warping and curving space, and things that would then travel in the vicinity of massive objects that are warping or curving space would move differently, and this is what we would perceive of as gravity. So like in electromagnetism, we have gravity as this field theory, but here we're talking about the actual geometry of space and time. In electromagnetism, we can get get electromagnetic waves by accelerating charges. And in gravity, we can have certain configurations of accelerating masses that will dynamically warp space-time and in certain situations will create these ripples that will propagate away from a system that we call gravitational waves. Now, this is a misleading picture for many reasons also, Avery, but it does illustrate the... Yes, good, all right. But anyway, this is the basic idea. So why do we care about this?
So why is this misleading?
So what do you think is going on here? Maybe it depends on your perspective. So you're seeing a two-dimensional sheet, and you're being asked to like expose this curvature as an extrinsic third dimension. Some people sort of think of this in a funny way. But it does illustrate there are other things wrong with this too, I think, in terms of wavelengths and things. But it's a cartoon example that hopefully motivates this a bit. And why we care about gravitational waves are the same reason why we care about electromagnetic waves from the perspective of the fact that they carry a tremendous amount of information about their sources. For those of us who are fortunate to have sight as one of our senses, we basically perceive effectively everything we know about our world and the universe through sight. They say seeing is believing. And with And it's because light conveys information about its source, but it also bounces off things and other phenomena. But with gravitational waves, we can, in principle, have the same effect. We can learn about the universe through this entirely new channel. And so this is why we're interested in this topic. So what's the observable effect? Well, since gravitational waves are actually changing space itself, what we would expect as an observer is to be able to see the change in, say, the relative distance between two points occur as a gravitational wave passes through. So a gravitational wave passing into this screen, if this is a piece of graph paper on this screen, will have the effect of stretching and squeezing space transverse to the direction of propagation. And the amount of stretching and squeezing depends on the distance between the points. So if you look in, for example, the center here, one of these small squares, you see a relatively small stretching and squeezing in terms of absolute distance. But if you were to consider the corners, you see obviously a much larger effect. The ratio of the stretching and squeezing to the distance itself is called strain, and that's the observable effect of gravitational waves passing through. So we do a better job in terms of detecting a gravitational wave signal by having a larger distance over which to measure a change in distance. Because I like this graphic so much, and it came out only recently, I want to show you the three-dimensional version too. So this is the same sort of thing going on, but you're now seeing it extended into three dimensions. There's a concentric ring of particles, concentric rings of particles along some tube. If you focus on the front here, you can see this stretching and squeezing of this ring, which is just like the stretching and squeezing of this grid. But you're seeing the entire wave train of some possible gravitational wave source traveling, or possible gravitational wave traveling through space, distorting this tube. Okay, so although Einstein predicted the possibility of gravitational waves actually quite early on, there was not really any clear idea of what could be plausible sources to produce an appreciable gravitational wave strain, or any technology that could access the strains at the level that would need to be accessed. But as we continue to learn more about our universe, we learned about compact objects. And so compact objects for the purpose of this talk will be two classes, neutron stars and black holes. And in both cases, they're tremendously dense things that compress something like the mass of our entire sun into something that's maybe of order 10 kilometers. And in both cases, these are possible results of normal stellar evolution. So a star grows old, burns up all of its fuel, begins to collapse under its own gravity. If the star is extremely massive, it'll collapse down to a neutron star, which is basically like a giant atomic nucleus, even a little bit more dense than that, but is an extremely compact object. If a star is even more massive than that, the neutron star itself can't stay formed and will continue to collapse under gravity, and you'll get a black hole, which may be just a single point in space, or maybe there's something else going on here. But no matter what, it's this object that has an extreme density and an event horizon beyond which nothing can escape, not even light. In the 60s, compact objects dynamics under gravitational waves were understood pretty well in many different ways. And this basic picture, I think, was understood. A binary system of two compact objects would be rotating, and if they're in a tight binary, would give off quite a bit of energy in gravitational waves. And this energy that was taken away in gravitational waves would cause this binary to merge. And in fact, within a reasonable time, possibly less than the age of our universe, gravitational waves could actually drive these compact binary systems to merge together completely and form, at the end, a final black hole. There was a pretty good idea even in the very early 60s about the dynamics of this and how gravitational waves caused this early in-spiral phase to happen. And people had understood sort of what the final thing might look like and the stability of this final black hole that might form under these circumstances. But a lot of the details in the middle, when the objects were under extreme gravitational attraction and also moving at near relativistic speeds or relativistic speeds, we didn't understand this until really the last decade, when people were able to solve, people in this room, in fact, were able to solve this motion of compact objects numerically on supercomputers. Okay, so in the 60s, we already had this sort of idea that compact objects could be a good gravitational wave source. There were other things people were thinking about as well. But given that they actually produced amplitudes that, well, were still maybe hard to access, but not completely out of the question, there began an experimental effort. And the first attempt to detect gravitational waves was by Joe Weber at the University of Maryland. He started in the very early 60s. And his idea was pretty straightforward. A gravitational wave that's propagating somewhere along through space, like this represented by this tube here, is stretching and squeezing space transverse to its motion. And if his idea was basically to put a large resonator in the way of the gravitational wave, and this resonator, which was really a large aluminum bar, had some ringing frequency. It had a fundamental frequency that it would like to vibrate at. A passing gravitational wave could induce a vibration in this and sort of effectively transfer some of this energy from the gravitational wave into what you could think of as an extremely small sound. And Weber actually effectively did this for decades and was ultimately never successful. But some of his experimental techniques were foundational in the field. And in fact, he inspired a whole generation of other experimentalists to try to repeat some of his experiments. And they advanced this technology of the mechanical resonators quite far and managed to do some fairly impressive experiments. But in the end, it was not enough. And I've sort of avoided telling you the sort of expected strain amplitude for a gravitational wave. But this is what Weber was up against. For sources that might have interacted with his detector, sort of in the most optimal cases, he was looking to try to find stretching and squeezing at the level of equivalent to taking the entire Milky Way galaxy and stretching and squeezing it by the height of a single person. So this is a 1 part in 10 to the 21. And that would have been sort of an optimistic scenario for Weber to have detected at that point, although maybe he himself wasn't aware that it was such a dire situation. Yes.
So, I mean, he never really estimated like the signal he's looking for.
He did, and actually, at a couple times, I think he didn't have it quite right, which people ultimately corrected him on. And there was even this compact binary scenario was not the only thing that was floating around at the time. And so, actually, the true story is that he actually claimed to have made gravitational wave detections, which many of you may know about. And actually, there was a time in the field where people were actually trying to explain what kind of possible things he could be observing. So there was actually, the story is not quite as clean as what one would present here in a colloquium. It was a bit of a messy business. And ultimately, the reason why we know that he wasn't successful was because he managed to get several other experimenters to try to reproduce his results. And they were never able to find the same thing that Joe was looking for, or that Joe had claimed to find.
So what was the strain that he could?
Oh, it was, oh goodness, it was like 10 to the minus 15, 10 to the minus 16, I think, at best. It was quite a bit off, yeah, yeah.
What are the limits from existing Weber bars, existing resonators?
After his initial attempts, like how far do they get?
What's the state of the art?
What is the state of the art?
Well, we were talking about this before, and I think we concluded that Allegro, which was an experiment that was at LSU, got down to 10 to the minus 17 or 18, possibly, somewhere in that area, at the frequencies, of course, that they resonate at, which, roughly speaking, most of these objects are a kilohertz, because that's roughly set by their size. Okay, so anyway, great idea, ultimately not successful. So we had to go beyond this and look at different detector technologies. Now this particular experimental apparatus already, I would hope to many of you, looks quite sophisticated. This is in fact a prototype at Caltech in the 80s and early 90s. And it is a laser interferometer. So the idea here is also quite simple and straightforward. So just to remind everyone how a laser interferometer works, you have a laser, goes to a beam splitter. The job of the beam splitter is to reflect half the light and to transmit the other half. A beam splitter at 45 degrees angle will then send a laser light down two orthogonal paths. We put mirrors at the end of each path. The light would bounce back, go to the beam splitter, and recombine. If the paths are identical, the light will recombine constructively. If there's a change, you'll in general get some sort of interference pattern. A gravitational wave passing down through the interferometer, or through this page, is going to stretch and squeeze space, at least for one of its polarizations, in this fashion here. And that will change the relative distance that the light travels in each arm. And we can then basically look at the interference pattern of the light and infer the time-dependent gravitational wave strain by recording the time-dependent interference of the laser light. This, like I said, is already a fairly elaborate experiment, much beyond what we would normally consider a tabletop experiment. These arms, it's tough to tell from this photo, are 40 meters long each. So it's a non-trivial size. But to be successful, we ultimately had to go to a much larger scale, in fact, 100 times larger. And the US built two large-scale laser interferometers, the LIGO observatories in Louisiana and in Washington State. These laser interferometers would look a lot like that prototype I sent you, but imagine sort of multiplying everything by, well, the length by 100, and then the rest of the dimensions not quite by 100, but they're quite enormous things. These two detectors are run by the US, and we partner with another comparable size facility in Italy called Virgo that has 3 kilometer arms. Okay, so then going back to this compact object paradigm, we have, we know compact objects are possible gravitational wave sources. By the time LIGO was built, we actually knew even more than that. So there were observations of binary neutron star systems in our galaxy that had periods of sort of hours, order hours. And careful measurements showed that they were actually, that the orbital period was decaying, and it was decaying precisely at the rate that you would expect from the emission of gravitational waves. So by the 90s, it was more or less a certain thing that gravitational waves should be given off by binary neutron stars, and it really just boiled down to what did we need to do to detect sources like that. So the best estimates at how often, I should also add that because of the limitations of ground observations, we only have access to fairly high frequency gravitational waves, which means frequencies of sort of order 100 hertz. And that corresponds to being only able to observe sort of the last few moments of a binary coalescence. So the question is how often do these binaries actually merge in, for example, our own galaxy? And the best guess is sort of optimistically, neutron stars may only merge once every few thousand years in our own galaxy. So we either build a detector that can measure gravitational wave strains from any neutron star systems in our galaxy and then wait 3,000 years, which is not practical. Or we try to build a detector, of course, that can observe more of the local universe and hopefully leverage the fact that these things should exist in other galaxies as well to catch something in the act. And obviously, that's what we did. The initial LIGO instruments began operations in the early 2000s. By 2005, they had reached their initial design and were able to sort of survey order hundreds of galaxies for neutron star mergers. So if a neutron star merger was within the sort of local universe out to maybe about the Virgo cluster, we would have been able to see such mergers. We operated from 2005 to 2010 and didn't detect anything. Everyone knows that. But we only saw hundreds of galaxies, and realistically, we probably needed to see thousands in order to be guaranteed to be successful. So fortunately, the NSF had the foresight to give us more funding to improve the LIGO detectors. And so from 2010 to 2015, effectively all of the internal components of LIGO were ripped out and replaced with better hardware that was with the goal of ultimately eventually reaching a design where we could access 1,000 times more galaxies than what we could initially. We began operations in 2015, but we did not start our operation at the full design sensitivity, and instead we were somewhere about a factor of 30 more than this. And so we could see thousands of galaxies, maybe close to 10,000 roughly. And of course, everyone knows that finally on September 14th, it's loud. So we finally did it, and it was announced in February. Getting 30 times more galaxies in sort of our way of describing a relative sensitivity was enough to get us over the hurdle of actually being able to access compact binary mergers. And so what we observed is a binary black hole system. So about a billion years ago, a little more than a billion years ago, there were two black holes in a tight binary, each one about 30 times the mass of the sun. And they were rotating around one another, giving off tremendous amounts of energy and gravitational waves. And this was causing them to merge. And eventually, they got so close together that they coalesced to form a single black hole. This is not just an artist's rendition of what happened. It's also not what we observe. It would be pretty wonderful if LIGO saw these excellent HD videos of all of our mergers. Like, it's kind of a dream of mine, but I don't think that'll ever happen. But this is, in fact, a realistic simulation, a numerical simulation of binary parameters that are consistent with what we observed. And my understanding is even that the folks who did this sort of starry background managed to get the optics pretty close to right as well. And so in some sense, what you're seeing here with how light is being distorted and warped as these things merge together is, in fact, a good description of what one would see. Okay, so what we actually observe is, unless you're me, or someone in my field who has spent years convincing ourselves that this is cool, what we actually observe is not quite as interesting as that video. Remember, all our observable here is really just a change in length, right? We're looking for the strain, the change in the gravitational wave, the change in the arm lengths of the detectors induced by the gravitational wave. So we get a strain as a function of time. It's a single time series data. And this is what we observed. So here we have on the y-axis strain in units of 10 to the minus 21, and time on the x-axis, and this is in seconds, and you can see it spans just a fraction of a second. This is the raw strain data from the Hanford detector and the Livingston detector, where this image has actually both of them superimposed after a time and phase shift. This is really the raw strain data. The only thing that's been done to this is a band passing to isolate roughly the spectral content of this particular signal. But otherwise, you're really seeing what we observed. And our best guess at what this looks like sort of denoised is this row here. And there are several different techniques that we used to figure out what this waveform looked like. And this is such a loud and pronounced signal from our perspective that it sort of doesn't matter. Everything agrees. And what you notice about this signal is that it's increasing in amplitude as a function of time, and it's also increasing in frequency. So the cycles here, everything's getting closer together. And this increase in amplitude and frequency is precisely what we would expect from a compact binary merger. As the thing rotates, obviously as it's getting closer together, it's orbiting more quickly. And that's actually also the fact that it's closer together means that it's radiating even more. So we expect for a compact binary this increase in both frequency and amplitude. And after the thing merges together, it settles down to a stationary black hole, and we see the gravitational waves damp down. 10 to the minus 21, just to remind you, that is the ratio of roughly the difference of a person's height compared to the Milky Way galaxy. And this is, in fact, precisely the amplitude, the peak amplitude of the strain that was observed.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So the residuals that you show, can you...
The residuals?
Yes, the residuals. Yeah. So is there a reduced chi-square that you have for the trend, or is something equivalent to that that you have?
Yeah, so let me explain the residual for those of you who may not follow. I didn't describe it. This is this is what the data would look like if we take what we observed and subtract our best guess at what the signal is, and what you're left over with is noise. Yes, you can compute a reduced chi-squared, and the, it's consistent with the degrees of freedom in the data, which means that it's consistent with the residual being Gaussian noise.
Okay, so you're saying it's a very good fit, and
it's effectively a perfect fit, yeah. I mean, the LIGO data is it's colored noise, it has a frequency spectrum or whatever. It's also non-stationary components, so it's tricky to say that that's the end-all statistic to use, but this was actually during a reasonably clean time. And when you subtract out the signal, it looks quite Gaussian. Okay, so GW159114, even though we didn't tell you to February, so we detected it, the date, this name gives you the date. We detected it on September 14th, 2015. We didn't tell you about it until February 11th, but we actually made the detection within 3 minutes of the signal arriving at Earth. So the gravitational wave arrived at Earth, we detected it. 3 minutes later, we knew it was there. We uploaded it to our internal candidate database. And the thing about this is that we actually observed this before the run had even officially started. So that's OK. We were in a stable mode of operation, and everything was good. But we didn't have a real sense of what the data looked like in terms of what background it may produce, et cetera. So this was really quite early and in some sense caught us by surprise. But what is true is that whatever it was, it definitely seemed to be far more significant than anything that we'd observed in the last days or weeks. It was confirmed within 8 hours by another automated process that basically found identical parameters. So by previous arrangement, the LIGO and Virgo collaborations had agreed to alert other astronomical observing facilities that signed up an agreement with us if we detected any gravitational wave candidates in advanced LIGO. We had 63 separate teams spread out all over the world that had this agreement with us. And although we would have liked this to have gone a bit faster, within 2 days, we managed to alert everyone that we had found something interesting. Of the 63, 25 of these partners followed up this signal. So the hope here is not necessarily for this kind of signal, but we want to try to correlate the gravitational wave observations with other electromagnetic observations. And so that's ultimately the goal. Of the 25, we had both space and ground-based observatories and spanned 19 orders of magnitude in the electromagnetic spectrum. I should say, the black holes are pretty small. Sort of like order 100, 200 kilometers. And they're really close together. So they're a point source on the sky, right? There's no doubt about that. Unfortunately, because of our detectors and the really long wavelength of gravitational waves, even though it's in principle a very small point source in the sky, we don't really know where it's coming from. With only two detectors, it's particularly challenging. So the best we can do is constrain the location of the gravitational wave source to these sort of broad rings on the sky and assign a relative probability. Despite the fact that it was pretty challenging, groups actually tiled this entire parameter space to try to do, or to this entire sky map rather, to try to figure out if there were any counterparts. And it's probably a little tough to see, especially for this, but you can see in the inset these squares corresponding to individual telescope pointings that people had done. And it covered tons, like I said, tons of the electromagnetic spectrum. And it was a huge effort. It was a long effort, too. The x-axis here is days going from, you know, 0 to more than 100. We knew pretty early on we were fortunate that it was actually archival data that we were able to correlate after the fact. But then a lot of these observations happened right after the circular went out. We observed x-ray, optical, and radio. And my understanding is that this is really still ongoing, and it may be ongoing for a while, basically as long as people are willing to try to look. All right, so we wouldn't have been able to tell you at that time the gravitational waves were a sure thing. We couldn't have written the PRL that day and you know, told the world, despite the fact that you would have maybe wanted us to do that. We really did try to get, we wanted to meet a certain level of care with the analysis to make sure that we really were establishing these to what the community would expect us to do. So we threw quite a bit of stuff at it. we have effectively two different ways of looking at the data for transients. We have a sort of generic way that does an unmodeled search that makes minimal assumptions about the waveforms except for the timescales and the frequencies of the strain content. It doesn't try to predict the actual strain time series. And we have other techniques where, in the case of compact binaries especially, even though they're complicated to model, binary black holes especially have very few degrees of freedom, just masses and spins. So it's possible to actually exactly predict, or pretty close to exactly predict, the gravitational wave strain. And when we do that, we're able to actually get a much more sensitive search. So even though, in fact, both these techniques were critical in establishing this first detection, because in fact they were both very sensitive, I'll mostly be talking about this category, since that's really the relevant one going forward, I think. All right, so we have GR predicted gravitational waveforms that provide the exact strain. And the idea is to tile a given parameter space and to convolve all of those things with the data, and to demand that both detectors observe the same signal within the expected time. The binary black holes have masses and spins. And so you need to have two mass components and two spin vectors to describe the dynamics, assuming that they're circular and other things. Here you're seeing a compression of that information down to just M1 and M2. The x and y axis, so that they go from 1 to 100 in component masses. And since M1 and M2 could be symmetrically defined, it's only half of this is shown. But each one of these colored dots, which is probably even difficult to see at the back of the room, represents a different model that we had to independently search in the data. And the reason for that is because even though qualitatively all these things are doing something similar, if you were to look at what an observable binary black hole waveform in the LIGO data would look like when it was up here at high mass, it might look like this. And if it's down here towards the edge of the yellow at the bottom left, it might be relatively long. Both are binary black holes, but small changes in the parameters of the system, like the masses, lead to pretty different waveforms. And you can kind of think of all of these dots as parameterizing, you know, everything in between these two scenarios. All in all, there were 250,000 models that we had to search. And I think something interesting to point out here is what our prior belief on the most interesting things to look for at the time was. We start with the things that we consider to be the most important, get those out of the way first. We basically initially searched for systems between 1 and 100 solar masses in component masses with a cutoff in the total mass of 100 solar masses. And you can see this white circle indicates where GW150914 was. So it was just barely within what we would consider to be the plausible parameter space to search for black holes.
Is that statement strictly true? Is it that you expected there to be no 30-30 solar mass binaries, or is it that you weren't sufficiently confident that 30-30 solar mass binaries existed and you chose to focus your search on things you knew were there?
Yeah, I think the statement, as I said, is true, is that we prioritized what we believed was the most plausible. There's nothing stopping us from searching higher, and in fact we are, but we have to do things in some order to get any results out. And this is what and even this was actually a debate, frankly. Like, we would have stopped this, perhaps at 50 or something like that, and this signal would have been invisible to us. We would have gotten to it eventually, but maybe not by February.
Chad, is there a corresponding prior on the non-modeled search, the generic search?
So that's an excellent question. And historically, well, there's always a prior, right? As a Bayesian, anyone who says it's not a prior just means they don't know what it is. But whether there was an explicit one historically, not usually, but people have really started to do that more often. And in fact, the unmodeled searches can build in like a prior that the time frequency evolution should look roughly like a post-Newtonian evolution to try to track tracks in time frequency plane without being extremely specific about what, you know, the actual phase evolution looks like. Does that answer the question, or are we getting at something slightly different than that?
More like, is there a built-in built-in restriction on the wavelengths of a generic
form
that you're looking for in a model search?
No, absolutely. So
does that roughly correspond to this range of templates?
So the modeled search typically assumes that the signal is short, where short means less than or much less than 1 second. But otherwise could have any frequency content within the detector sensitivity. Fortunately, this signal, being that it was extremely short and also very loud, meant that the unmodeled search found it. And it could have been otherwise. I mean, had we not done this, and had we not had the unmodeled search, it might have been, you know, a year before we would have sorted this out, is the truth. So we were fortunate to not be in that situation. Okay, so we had two completely independent ways. Yeah.
So you're saying that now you've expanded this region that you're searching?
Yeah, so we've known that there's a good reason to have to go to higher masses, because there could be possibly like intermediate mass black holes that could be causing this, right? But again, it's all about priorities, really. And the first thing we start with is the things that we think are most likely.
But now that has changed.
Now that has changed, yes.
What they think is likely has changed.
Yes, exactly. It's you know, our prior has been updated by the observation. Yeah, so I think you'll see future banks not stop here, is what it'll boil down to. Yeah. We've learned our lesson. Okay, so we did two independent searches, so people get a sense of how the significance is calculated here. Two completely independent matched filter analyses, all of them convolve all of these 250,000 different waveforms with the data. And the point is that no matter what, this is greater than 5 sigma significance by a long shot. And so let me explain what we mean by that, because I don't know that every community has a consistent perspective on what that means. So here's what we mean. Sorry, these are some of the more technical, probably boring plots, but I'll explain them so hopefully folks can understand. The y-axis of both plots is number of events. The x-axis is for these two plots is different, but the meaning is basically the same. It's a ranking statistic that ranks least likely to be a gravitational wave to most likely. So here you're least likely, here you're most likely in both cases, even though the variable itself is different. The black line is an estimate of the background where we try to figure out how often we would accidentally get a signal by noise that is not astrophysical between the two detectors. And the orange squares are the actual observed results. So you can see GW150914 in both analyses lives off at one event at a very high likelihood of being a gravitational wave, and in a region where there is simply absolutely no background at all, none. So in this case, if we were to have, I mean, this already establishes here, if you take the integral of this, this is a differential plot, don't get me started on that, but if you were to look at the integral of this, this already establishes a bound of 5.1 sigma or better in both cases. But it's pretty easy to eyeball. This thing is so far off in the tail that it's likely to be much, much, much more significant than that. And we would have expected to have waited much more than 200,000 years for something like this to happen accidentally. Okay, but in some sense, the real interesting things here and what we can really extract by the fact that we know the waveforms, that we can predict the waveforms from GR, is that we're able to actually learn a lot about the binary system itself. And it's precisely because small changes in the parameters lead to non-trivial changes in many cases to the observed signal, that we can invert the problem and say, given what we've observed, what does that tell us about the plausible binary parameters? And we can get basically probability distributions for the masses and spins, et cetera. And what we've learned is the two masses are, as I said before, roughly 30 solar masses, but the primary may be a bit heavier, somewhere between 32 and 41 times the mass of the sun, and the secondary somewhere between 25 and 33. How we've described the constraints on the spins of the black hole is maybe not extremely clear. So let me try to clear that up a little bit. This is how we describe the probability distributions for spins. So you're seeing the color here represents like a probability, with the brighter color being more probable. This is a polar plot. The radius gives the magnitude. It goes up to 1 being the maximum allowed value. The angle is the spin tilt relative to the angular momentum. So let me do a visual here. Spins, okay, black holes have two numbers, spin and mass. But obviously spin is a vector, it's a vector quantity. If you've got two of them, direction matters. So I'll use my thumbs for the spin vectors of the black holes, my fists as the black holes, and I'll use myself as the orbital angular momentum. Everyone good with that? All right, so this is not much spin, right? Because my thumbs are down. Okay, good. This is important. This is the best explanation you'll ever get. All right, so we basically know the following. They could be this, not much spin, okay? They could be this, or this, or possibly this, but they're definitely not this, or this. Everyone good? Crystal clear, right?
There's no consensus.
Pretty much, yes. It's like, anyway, I won't go there. No, the thing is that it has a small effective spin, and what that really means is that it's a special combination, mass-weighted combination of the spins that meant that if there are large spins, they basically have to be anti-aligned with respect to the orbit angle, with respect to one another. And I'll say something else about that here in a second. Because there's another way you can get at that as well. So we also don't know, I mean, depending on the angle we're seeing this thing at, we're going to get a different amplitude that's observed here at Earth, and depending on the sky position. So the orientation will affect how much of the gravitational wave signal we actually observe. So what that ultimately means is, since you saw how poorly we constrain things on the sky, I won't go the whole way back there. But we ultimately don't know the distance to be all that precisely. But our best guess, the 90% interval is somewhere between 230 and 570 megaparsecs, which is roughly a redshift of 0.1. And the final mass is between 58 and 67 solar masses, and three solar masses were radiated throughout its life. And the final spin of the black hole is between 0.57 and 0.72. And in fact, it peaks at about 0.67. And it turns out this is exactly consistent with what you would expect if you had these non-spinning black holes, which merge and then smash together, and sort of the angular momentum that hasn't been radiated is conserved and forms this final black hole. So the final spin is quite consistent with two non-spinning black holes merging and getting this final spin.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
The degeneracies between the parameters here are fundamental degeneracies.
Yes.
These things that will be gotten rid of. So all we can expect is for these ellipses to shrink.
They're fundamental, almost. There are cases where some of these degeneracies can be further broken by spin precession. So if we're ever lucky to observe, if we've got really strong spins that are have an arbitrary alignment, the entire orbital plane will kind of wobble. And that additional modulation in the amplitude and phase can help to break some of the degeneracies in some of these other parameters. It's a weak thing, it's not like a magic bullet, but it is possible, people have shown under certain circumstances that it helps. But otherwise, there are lots of degeneracies. And you know, it's even more complicated than this. I mean, there are 15 parameters that we searched for, I think. And so you really have to think about this 15-dimensional parameter space and all of the correlations. And we can pretty much only show two or three dimensions at a time.
So sorry, here you don't see the precession because of the way the plane is with respect to us, or it's just too small?
So there are a couple of options there. Either there isn't any, which may be true. Or if there is, there are two reasons why it's not really observable. The orientation is part of it, and also there are very few cycles. We don't have access. I mean, like, it's not something we can just measure well. If nature was really conspired to give us something super strong, we might have been able to say something, but at this point, we're just not sure. But the statements about the spins, whether or not there's some angle that would have caused the spin to be precessing or not, you know, basically if it's a tilt that's not aligned, we're not sure of, but we are pretty sure that the effective spin is small, which meant it's not this and it's not this. Okay, so some of you probably have paid attention to this, but maybe not all. It was given like all of one sentence in the PRL
But some of the other papers go into a little bit more detail about this, and I want to take a second to explain it. There was a second interesting event, which we called LVT 151012. And those of you eyeballing these histograms would have said, well, what's going on with the second orange point here, right? In fact, quite remarkably, both of these independent analyses found this second event with eerily similar parameters. That can happen accidentally, but even though we can't make this statement rigorous yet, although we could if we worked harder, this sort of thing happens more often when there's something legitimate, right? So we find a very similar parameters for the second loudest event. Unlike the first event, it's 2 sigma, so it has a 2% chance of being noise. That's not strictly true either if Avery wants to criticize the statistical statement. But it's roughly speaking, that's an interpretation. So this other event, if it's real, the parameters that we estimate in that same way are also consistent with a binary black hole. It's a bit lighter, with a primary of 23 and a secondary of 13 solar masses. And it's further away. The distance is much more uncertain here, but it's likely to be more than a gigaparsec away. So between the fact that it's further away and that it's lighter means that overall the amplitude that we measured is quite a bit smaller, which is why it's not significant, of course. The signal-to-noise ratio, for those of you who have a sense of what that means, is only 7 in each detector compared to the 20 for GW15 and I14 in one of the detectors. So here's the thing. We're not, as a collaboration, coming out and saying this is real. That's the official statement, so that's on the recording, right? But the truth of the matter is that it's because we have established gravitational waves exist and binary black holes exist with this first event, it's natural as a human to then inform our future inference of other things as saying, well, maybe we should look more at these other weaker events. So we did that, especially from the perspective of trying to understand the coalescence rate, to get a sense of what to expect in the future. And before, we had these enormous uncertainties in the coalescence rate, somewhere between 0.1 and 300 mergers per gigaparsec cubed per year. After this, and taking everything into account, well, the ultra-conservative range is not much different between 2 and 400, but we really rule out the sort of order of 1/10 merger per year per gigaparsec. And in fact, this is a sort of ridiculously conservative range, not some 90% interval or something. It's very conservative. Likely what we're really observing here is maybe a range of rates somewhere between 30 and 100. So it's actually quite a bit higher, I think, than what people expected. And as all of you know, we've only published on the first third of our data that we've collected so far. So we owe you a 2/3 of the data, and this is the beginning of Advanced LIGO. Like, literally, this came on day minus one. So we've got some years ahead of us. Right now, we are down for commissioning. The whole goal here is to improve the sensitivity of the detector. So we're not really taking much data. Anything that we would do would be opportunistic. But we're hoping sometime late summer, early fall, to start observing again, where we increase the volume of space that we can see, or the number of galaxies, by a factor of 3. And then we'll iterate one more time, and hopefully get to a full factor of 10 by the fall of 2017. So what that means is that with this increased volume of space and our inferred rates, O2 could have a detection as often as 1 BBH per month, or more often than that, and O3 could have a detection as often as 1 per week. And I think the game that we're going to play in the years to come is to try to understand something about formation scenarios from the populations. So GW15914 was heavier than we had expected, and it implies that the progenitor stars were actually quite big. They couldn't have shed much mass from stellar wind. It means that they probably had to be in a low metallicity environment. So this is starting to tell us some things about the formation scenarios. And a low metallicity environment could happen one of two ways. Either the universe has conspired in modern times to produce something that has a low metallicity, or this binary actually formed early in the universe before there was a lot of stuff other than hydrogen and helium. And it just taken the entire length of the universe to merge. So I think even though, well, let me explain this plot for a second. I don't want to dwell too much because I'll run out of time. So here on the y-axis, we have the maximum black hole mass that we would have thought was possible from normal stellar evolution versus the metallicity. Both have units of their solar quantity. So this is solar masses and solar metallicity. Previously, people thought that at the end of the star's life, the winds of blowing the star apart were quite strong. And it really meant that it was unlikely to produce black holes maybe more than 25 or 30 solar masses. People did revise this and thought that maybe there can be weaker winds than what were previously thought, which would allow, in general, larger maximum masses. But you can see these two lines here indicating the primary and secondary mass for GW150 and M14. And it's quite a bit beyond what people would have originally thought. Still consistent with some of these new models, but I think we all have to ask ourselves, is something like this confirming what we maybe already knew, or are we completely off base? And fortunately, there are people out there who are thinking outside the box on this, which I think is wonderful. Those of you probably read this paper from Byrd et al. This is actually a plot from Carr et al., but they ultimately referenced this. In my opinion, tweaking our understanding of stellar evolution would be probably the most boring outcome that could come out of this observation. It would be wonderful if we learned something entirely different, right? This is informative, and we do learn a lot from stuff like this, and we will eventually pin these things down. But maybe something totally crazy is going on. They wanted us to consider that perhaps there is this. So this black hole. Sorry, I didn't explain this plot. This is the fraction of possible dark matter versus mass of primordial black holes. And this is constraints for how much black holes, primordial black holes of this particular mass could contribute to the overall dark matter. And there are tons of different constraints that come in at different places. This spans 35 orders of magnitude. The sun is in this area here. And they want us to say that possibly there's this window open where if you ignore some of the constraints, you do have to ignore some of the constraints that are model dependent, as we always like to do, that are model dependent, but that aren't strict observations like some of these other ones are, then maybe there's a window here for dark matter to be made up of all of these primordial black holes, and that's what we're actually seeing.
Is there some argument that this has to be kind of primordial and wasn't from multiple mergers or on other stuff or something?
No, sorry, you're totally right. It could be anything. Yeah, absolutely.
But if there were multiple mergers, wouldn't you expect a mass spectrum? And then you run
across. We've only seen one signal so far. So.
Well,
No. But you rule out, if it was going to be mergers of things that started at 10, Macha would rule it out. If it was going to continue on to things that became a few hundred, white binary searches would rule it out.
Yeah, you've opened a Pandora's box, so I'm glad you've asked this question. Here's the thing. You can draw a lot of spectra, mass spectra, through this that does not violate any constraints and explains virtually all of dark matter. I think that's a true story. Right?
Can you keep that mass spectra over 15 billion years?
I don't know about that, but you definitely can, because some of these constraints are quite weak. And in fact, I was inspired to go back and look at the original microlensing papers. And I should talk about this afterward, because otherwise we could spend an hour debating this. There's even some tension still here. So if you ask me, can we draw a spectrum through here that would explain dark matter? Yes. And in fact, we won't know until we start measuring these things. And thankfully, we hopefully will be in a situation where we're amassing an enormous catalog. And the question then becomes, what does this mass spectrum look like? So we're going to histogram these things up as a function of mass. We're going to histogram the spin tilt angle. And we're going to try to see, are these things stellar evolution, or are these things something else? And this is how we're going to do it. And this is where most of our effort's going to go.
But if you go out, you don't actually get the mass function. What you get is a mass function of the things that are merging. So it could be things that are not merging.
That's right. There are tons of selection effects. You're totally right. We'll measure this. It's true that you get the mass function of things that are merging, and also based on our ability to even detect mergers itself. So any selection effects that we have from our own instrumental and experimental practices will also be baked into this. So I'm not saying it's going to be easy to disentangle all these things, but this gives you an entirely new channel
to search for this.
I guess those are very different, because in principle, clever experimentalists should be able to identify the selection effects of their apparatus.
We can do that.
But you need, that's right, but figuring out the selection effects associated with binary evolution, that's a nightmare. Right? Because it's not a matter of being, you know, clever systematic control of your experiment.
It's a research program, so.
Yeah, that's right. It's a research program that's gone on for a very long time because it is an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, but I mean, come on. So you're right, but there are definitely strong signatures that could be present. I mean, the thing is yeah, if it's marginal, maybe we don't learn anything until we've collected a tremendous amount of things and advanced our understanding of solar evolution, but. Naively, one would expect, probably since most stars are small, you would expect that the actual population of these things coming from stellar evolution should have something that's consistent with the stars we observe, roughly. I know there are tons of effects in that.
Not at all. I don't understand why. So what you've been talking about, you have completely ignored the possibility that the binary was formed at the center of a globular cluster, right? And then it could produce, gone through many, many mergers up to this point, so then it could have nothing to do with the underlying population of stars that produce it.
I'll give you one that's a pretty smoking gun. We detect one down here. Below solar mass. No stellar evolution models predict anything, roughly speaking, below solar mass. We find a binary below solar mass that appears to be black holes. That's a smoking gun for something interesting.
Can LIGO see that?
Yes.
How far down can you get?
As far as you would like if you give me lots and lots of money.
For 400 megaparsecs, it's like, it would look like 2 neutron stars.
Don't you fall out of the frequency band when you make them too small? Yeah.
No, because you observe them further apart.
You don't see the merger.
You see the inspiral. Okay.
Yeah, you see the inspiral, not the merger.
You will see the inspiral, but it depends on what the distance is. So if you were to take, yeah, it depends on the populations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yes. So absolutely. It's harder because we have a smaller distance to observe them,
yeah,
to.
So let me say that I guess we could ask the question. Usually these populations predict that there's a minimum black hole mass at around 4 or 5 solar masses, right? This is simulation,
yes,
that I've seen.
Yes.
So if you were to move all that distribution, just move it to lighter masses, let's say at 1 solar mass, if that 4 was 1, would you be able to see this with current population distributions of black holes, the 1 solar mass mergers? That would be a yes.
Well, so the question is, well, the question of whether or not we can tell the difference between the neutron star and the black hole, I mean, that's the problem in some sense at small masses, is it a neutron star or is it a black hole? You have to start measuring effects that depend on the matter. Tidal effects or
electromagnetic counterparts,
or a lack of electromagnetic counterparts, we start to build a case. Tidal, if you can measure any tidal effects, or if you don't observe the full, you know, inspiral merger ring down. But it gets more complicated at lower masses because all that stuff starts to happen at higher frequencies that we're not sensitive to.
But that's outside the merger. You don't see the ring down or the merger.
It's not. So with LIGO, it's hard. But like, these are things that are like not fundamental problems from the perspective of what we may be able to access in the next decades if this becomes an area that we have to understand more. I'll go on, but we should talk about this more afterward because I think there's a group here that would want to delve in. Okay. Where's the matter?
Going back to the spin distribution.
Yes.
Do you have any idea about the size? Because here you say the tilt angle. Do you have any idea about the spin distribution in terms of size? How big should the spin of the black hole be?
The people that have lots of different predictions for such things, depending on the scenarios, under circumstances of normal stellar evolution or under circumstances of other things
like in a binary, right? Because things, so the merging black holes, what is the expected spin distribution of the merging black holes in this?
Well, I've heard everything over the years from like nearly maximal to maybe not. So I don't know. Does anyone in the field want to feel confident that they can say anything other than who knows? I think people generally expect one thing that is true is they generally expect there to be some agreement between the spin alignments because these things probably form from a common ball of stuff. They've accreted possibly throughout some things.
It depends.
That's right. So that's what I mean. Like, the thing is, you get an Avery in the audience who would disagree with anything. So I mean, it's the thing is, like, you don't know.
No, I don't.
Exactly. No, he wouldn't. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. But, I mean, like, it would be odd if we start seeing just, I don't know. If we start seeing lots of crazy misaligned spins, I don't know that anyone would have predicted that coming from normal stellar evolution. So that would be one thing, is if we really start seeing that just all over the place. We'll see. Good news is we might get a really big catalog. I mean, if things hold up, we'll have a lot of events. Where's the matter? Well, I'm so out of time. Nothing yet. Black holes are simple objects, few degrees of freedom. Of course, if we have neutron stars, they have lots of degrees of freedom. Who knows what's going on there? We'll have another probe of matter at pretty extreme densities and relativistic situations. Already, we think that neutron star mergers, for example, are the sources of short gamma ray bursts. They may have a host of electromagnetic counterparts, including gamma ray bursts, radio, and kilonova signatures, which happen after a day or so because of the ejecta undergoing nuclear reactions. People think that this might even be these reactions that happen after the binary merges, what's responsible for our current abundance of gold and platinum. So that's one of our funding sources for the future. And my thoughts are, initially, we only have so much resolution from the gravitational waves. The key here really is going to be whoever set it in the back, electromagnetic counterparts. Really, we will have to see, with what people call multi-messenger astrophysics, which would combine the gravitational wave observations with all of these other observing facilities, and importantly, computational modeling as well, because we really will have to have reasonable models for how to extract the best stuff out of the data. And I think putting this all together, at least for the foreseeable future, is the way we're going to put the universe under a microscope rather than just having a telescope pointing at it. And of course, we also want to go beyond LIGO. There are already plans for basically advancing present technology, taking interferometers, putting them underground, pulling out every trick in the book to try to get the next order of magnitude sensitivity. But I want to stress that we're really sort of like, you know, Galileo improved the telescope and saw craters on the moon or whatever. That was a long time ago. Now we've got things like the Hubble telescope. The ratio of those two scenarios is pretty large for conventional astronomy, no matter how you measure it, mirror size, resolving power, pick your favorite. Many orders of magnitude has been spanned. This is the beginning. This is sort of first light for gravitational wave astronomy. So we don't know where we're going to be in 100 years, let alone 300 or 400 years. My personal thoughts are, especially for people in this audience that like to ponder fundamental things in, for example, quantum measurement, is we need to be asking ourselves, is this even the right thing to do? What can we do to, have we gone down the right road of building the types of detectors we have, or is there something that we're missing? And I think that's really one of the ways we'll advance this field most quickly. All right, I will date myself here in the sense that there'll be like a narrow range of ages in this room that will know what this analogy means, around my age. Who out there, I promise I'm done after this, who out there ever played Where's Waldo? Raise your hand. Oh, see, it's not so bad. Or maybe I'm older than I thought.
There's two different hands, right? There's the people who found Waldo and the people who read Where's Waldo.
If you ask the people who know what Where's Waldo means, you'll be a larger
answer. Okay, it's fine. But that's what I mean. Okay, so good. So at least many of you know Where's Waldo. All right, so here's the deal. Where's Waldo was a game where you had to find this little guy. And yes, this isn't exactly Waldo. I'll get there in a second. You had to find this Waldo guy among some crazy background, like a carnival or something. I don't know, and that's the point, right? Who remembers the backgrounds for Waldo? No, right? I mean, it doesn't matter. You're looking for Waldo, right? So we have opened a new window in the universe, as we've been promising now for forever. And the thing is that maybe GW150914 was a bit like our Waldo. So we've opened this window, and we found something pretty close to exactly what we've been looking for. Granted, there are some differences. It's not exactly Waldo. He's changed his hat and shirt. But it's basically Waldo. And so the question really is, in my mind, is, has GW150914 been our Waldo? And are we missing a whole universe full of things that are there and even accessible in our data? And I will let you ponder that. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Yes.
I wanted to ask two little things. In the model waveform you showed, the one had what looked like a very fast road, and then sitting at an angle for a while, and then another burst at the end. And then the other one was, in your interferometer drawing, you have these big mirror cavities you didn't mention. You talked about that. No.
I will address both of those.
Thank you.
The first is disappointingly not physical. This taper that you notice at the beginning of the waveform, and very careful audience, I appreciate that very much. This taper at the beginning of the waveform, we oftentimes window our waveforms for numerical reasons, and I just sort of dumped some standard code. Sorry, that's what you're seeing here. It's not a physical effect. So you really should think of the observable stuff happening from here forward. We always just ramp.
It's just sort of tapering down.
It follows this exact trajectory, this envelope the whole way down to zero. And the amplitude is, of course, smaller at earlier times, but the actual integrated power, you actually get most of your power from low frequencies because you observe for a long, long time. And so if you ask about the frequency spectrum, most of the power is at low frequency because it'll sit there and irradiate for a long, long, long time at low frequencies. And the cavities, I didn't explain these internal cavities, but these are Fabry-Perot cavities. They're mirrors that are mostly reflect but allow a little bit of light to go through. What effectively you're doing, there's different ways of thinking about the physics here. They're equivalent, of course. I think the simplest thing is to imagine that what's effectively happening is it's letting this thing bounce back 100 times on average before it comes back out of the cavity. So the average photon will be going back and forth 100 times and then comes back out of the cavity. And that's equivalent to basically extending the arm for a long time. Because the gravitational wave timescale and wavelength is such that we're in this long wavelength limit, and this is effectively making the arm really long. It still doesn't get longer than the gravitational wavelength, so it doesn't start to cancel itself out. Yeah.
So you mentioned that there is more power at earlier times.
Yes.
Can you go back to the data and see that power?
No.
How do you stop?
Because even though there's more power in the signal, anyone who's seen way too many LIGO talks that we always show noise curves, I am so happy to not show noise curves anymore, because who cares? Right? We've got data. But a noise curve would have been helpful here. So this is characteristic amplitude of the noise versus frequency. And our LIGO spectra do something like this, right? And the power law for a binary is f to the minus 7/6, meaning so the amplitude of the gravitational wave radiation is higher at lower frequencies. But the problem is that the noise at low frequencies basically goes to infinity for all intents and purposes. So this effectively puts a limit as to how low in frequency you can observe. That was a really fast explanation.
Low in frequency is one thing, and then going to earlier time is another thing. You could still have, I guess it's effectively...
For binaries, it's equivalent, because the evolution is just monotonically increasing.
Well,
according
it's
to
similar, but not equivalent.
It's a very narrow band source, right? It's just a band.
It's a very narrow band. So the frequency... At early times, they have a lower frequency at this angle when you get there.
Yeah, so I should add that... So with the binary, you're basically... The instantaneous gravitational wave frequency to the lowest order is twice the orbital frequency. And you can assume, honestly, normal Newtonian mechanics for understanding everything until the very end. The closer it is, the faster it rotates. So when it's further away, you get lower frequencies, and it's roughly monotonic. And as it gets closer together, the thing increases. Precession systems and eccentric systems and stuff, things won't be exactly monotonic. But for anything that's like this, this is how it goes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So not to set you up, but you have your own top factor photo. So last year in this room, you had a prediction.
That's right.
The prediction would happen by October 31st, and you were right. So what's the next? What's the new prediction?
Let me explain that a little bit. I was here for convergence, right? Convergence, I think, right? I don't know when that was. It was kind of early, June.
July.
July? Okay, July. So this was before September, those of you who remember the calendar, I sometimes don't. So I didn't actually know about this event. And I did predict, in fact, that gravitational waves would be detected at least the 3 sigma level on or before Halloween of 2015. And it was, turns out that I was right. So what I've done is set up a small hedge fund. And those of you who would like a buy-in, it's 10,000 per person. I take checks, cash, credit cards. Talk to me afterwards.
Luis,
well, it used to be okay either way, and now not as much. No, I don't know. I'm not going to make a prediction. Come on. What do you want me to? I'll predict. All right. Here's what I'll do. I'll go after something crazy. All right. Oh, can I do that? Yeah, I'll do that. Turn off the recording device. Subsolar mass compact object by 2018.
Subsolar mass.
Subsolar mass.
Okay.
Might be 0.999999, but subsolar mass compact object by 2018, by the end of 2018. That's my prediction. Anything else?
My understanding, if you were on kind of the original committee evaluating your proposal, or just an advisor, and you guys said, look, you guys are looking for something that's what? I don't know the exact numbers. Something like 10 to the minus 12, 10 to the minus 14, smaller than the wavelength of the laser that you need to say.
We have lots of photons.
Yeah, okay, so can you break down roughly where the orders of magnitude is basically just from numbers of photons? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, the thing is you're effectively, I mean, worse than that, the mirror is not smooth to the nanometer scale, right?
Yeah.
So.
It's one of these things that first thing you do, yeah. First time you might say, come on, there's no way you could do something like this.
Yeah. But you can think of it in different ways. So, I mean, in the end, like, arguments like that, I think the trick is that it's averaging. We've got tons of photons. You're averaging over the mirror. You're averaging over each photon being slightly out of phase, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's why the more laser power you have, the more photons you have, the better your sensitivity is. So that's the simple answer. And the other thing is that if you work out what the energetics are, like how much you have to, you've got these mirrors on a pendulum, right? You have to move them a tiny amount, but it's a non-zero energy. Like it corresponds to things that might actually exist. I don't know if I did this calculation right. I might be wrong about this. I should probably know this off the top of my head. But I thought maybe it's something like 1 hertz photon. So it's like a pretty small energy, like, but not impossibly small. And so if you think about it in terms of energetics, it's like, oh, okay, fine. You should be able to make an apparatus that can measure that small of an energy. Yes?
Can you clarify a comment you made before in terms of this sort of an upper bound on how long you could make the arms before it has something to do with the wavelength of the gravitational wave?
Yeah, once the arms are like this, commensurate with the wavelength of the gravitational wave, like you'll actually start to get partial cancellation effectively, like the photons will be, well, the space-time will be stretched and squeezed before the photons have gotten back. And so things, so it's not that you can't detect it, but the response function becomes much more complicated and it has sort of frequencies which we're not sensitive to because of that.
A scheme that didn't require the photons to come back to some common area could get around that. Like if I used entanglement, for example, to try to detect a phase difference rather than bring it back to the same spot, could you get around that for bound?
Yeah, maybe. I think so. It sounds plausible. The other thing that entanglement could get you, if I remember my second semester graduate quantum mechanics, would be you can, in some sense, improve this quantum noise limit too, right? Which is that, like, I think you get, I mean, if you were somehow able to entangle a ton of photons but still do something normal, like a normal interferometer, you would end up getting a root n improvement in the shot noise. So a magic bullet for building a high-frequency gravitational wave detector, which could be interesting for neutron stars, would be to somehow have, like, a lot of entangled photons, but even a regular, I mean, I don't know how that works, but that's my understanding, that that's a possibility. Or people have suggested other things than photons too, but I don't know how hard that is.
So okay, so Chad is here till Friday morning. If anyone wants to grab him, he's around. Let's thank him again.